Are you curious about, interested in, or working within the field of anesthesiology, and you are a woman, person of color, or otherwise do not fit the stereotypical image of what an anesthesiologist looks like, then this is the podcast for you. We will discuss what life is like on the other side of the blue drape for us. Issues most relevant, such as what is anesthesia really? And we're not talking textbook definition. Tips for applying, success in residency, life as an attending, and beyond. Join us each week as we take a dive into this rich and often misunderstood field. This is your host, Dr. Alicia Peterson, and welcome to SIVO Sisters. I am so excited, guys. I have with me Dr. Amanda Budak. Now, what I just absolutely love is Amber Baruchi. I interviewed her in an earlier episode. I'll tag that in the show notes. And after that interview, she just said, you have to interview Amanda. She has the most incredible story. And so, as you know, here we are all about anesthesiologist stories, particularly women, people of color. We have such a unique trials, unique journeys. So I am really excited to hear your story. Please, like, introduce yourself to the audience.
Thank you for having me. I feel like I personally have like a lot of imposter syndrome. That's something I've definitely struggled with the whole way along the way. But I was born and raised on a small farm in rural upstate New York. My mom took 6 years to graduate from high school, but did eventually finish. My father did not finish high school. I had some family members who'd gone to college before, but not immediate family members. Everybody was kind of extended a couple generations back. And I was a little bit of a different child. Bless my mother. She's a very patient person. But my mom was advised when I was younger that you have a very smart daughter, make sure she gets a great education. And my mom really took that to heart. And I had a different than usual educational background. I went to traditional public school for a couple years. And our school system was small, didn't have a lot to offer anybody who wasn't middle of the pack. If you were a little on the slower side or a little bit on the faster side, there really wasn't anything they could do for you. And so my mom ended up homeschooling me in the fifth grade. And so fifth grade through, I say, the high school years, I was homeschooled. At the end of eighth grade, I actually started community college part-time because my mom was diagnosed with brain cancer. So that posed some like additional challenges of kind of like accessing education. I went away to college when I was 16. I was very fortunate. I was offered a scholarship somewhere. So moved from New York all the way down to Virginia, went to school, managed to graduate.
When we have our own stories, right? It's like, oh yeah, this happened, that happened, you know, continue on. And it's like, whoa. Huge life events and really unique. Just to kind of go back, you talked about your upbringing and how your mom finished high school. And she did a lot, sacrificed a lot to get you an education. So just off the bat, you didn't come from a family of doctors. You didn't come from money. Doesn't sound like you had some inheritance. Okay.
No. My dad was a car mechanic and my mom mostly stayed at home. She worked part-time during the winters at a ski resort just because she liked to ski and we couldn't afford to ski otherwise. So it was, we were very much a, if there's a will, you'll find a way sort of mentality in our household. And horses were my passion when I was younger and growing up. And that can be a very expensive sport. And my mom was of the mentality, if you really want to, you'll find a way. So got a job at 10 and saved all my pennies and quarters and got a second job cleaning stalls somewhere to pay for lessons. And don't worry, my mom also made sacrifices driving me to the barn at 4 o'clock in the morning in the middle of winter in upstate New York because somebody had to feed and turn out those horses that at 11 you can't drive. So like definitely having that robust built-in support network of people who may not understand the choice that you're making, but they understand that it's important to you. So they're going to be there to support that. That has definitely been a recurring theme from my immediate family and my extended family the whole way along.
And then that mindset of there's a way to do it. If you want it, you'll find a way. And that kind of grit and enterprising nature, I'm sure, is also going to come into play. Then you mentioned you finished high school at the age of 16 and went to college. Is that?
Technically speaking, when they do like statistics for our county, I am a high school dropout. I don't have a GED. I don't have a high school diploma. So my mom, where we lived, you had to fill out a piece of paperwork that told the public school, hey, I, Kathy Stefano, am homeschooling my daughter, Amanda Stefano. And like, that was it. We just had to tell them that you were homeschooling and you were homeschooling your child. And so when I was living at home with my mom in New York State and going to community college for all of my classes, we filled out those forms. When I went away to college in Virginia, I wasn't physically living in New York State. So my mom didn't fill out that paperwork. So I don't have a high school diploma. I don't have a GED. Technically, when my county does educational rosters, I am a high school dropout. I dropped out at the end of 10th grade. I had finished 2 years of college at that point at home, but I went away to college and the school I went away to was a four-year school and I was on a full scholarship. So I made the choice to stay all 4 years for social reasons. But yeah, so just because it's the way everybody else does something doesn't mean it's the way you have to do something. And just because there is a usual way of doing things doesn't mean that's the path you have to take to get there. Is it different? Yes. Has it caused problems? Yes, because every time I have to renew my medical license, I don't have a high school to put in because they ask about where you went to high school. And then I have to call the state licensing office and have the same conversation every year that I still have not graduated from high school. I still have a college degree. I still have my MD. I still finished a residency. Can you please approve my medical license? Here's a copy of the emails from 2 years ago. And every 2 years you do this.
Oh, wow. Incredible. And then you mentioned your mom had was diagnosed with brain cancer. So that diagnosis come before you went away to school or was?
So I was 11 when she got sick, but I had just turned 12 when she got a diagnosis. So it took a month, month and a half for her to get the diagnosis. And my birthday happened in that time. Her prognosis was not good when they first told her about it. They gave her 3 to 6 months. My mom had, I think over the course of the next 5 years, she had 5 brain surgeries. She had 2 types of standard chemo. She had 2 types of experimental chemo. She had stereotactic radiosurgery, which was still under clinical trial at the time. And my mom was homeschooling me throughout the vast majority of this process. So my mom can't drive because she's having seizures. She's having to arrange rides for herself from this rural part of middle of nowhere, upstate New York, to either the big hospital, like down in the city, which was about 45 minutes away, or the real big fancy hospital, which was 2, 2.5 hours away for surgery, for treatments, for doctor's visits, for chemo, for radiation sessions. So I spent a lot of time while she was sick, all my schoolwork in a book bag. And it's like, today we're going to spend 2 hours in the car. We're going to go down to Buffalo. Mom's going to have 3 or 4 doctor's appointments. We're going to maybe have a radio surgery session. And then we're going to wait around for a couple hours before somebody can give us a ride back. And then we're going to come back home again. And so we did that for a couple years. And that was just my everyday life. And my mom did a great job of trying to make sure meeting her needs didn't interfere with also meeting my needs, which I have no idea how she managed to do that. Because I have a sister who ended up not being homeschooled anymore at that point. She ended up going to private school and then back to public school. But I was still working a job where I worked 12 hours a week at one job and 10 hours a week at another job. At that point, I had my own horse at home. So I was responsible for the care and upkeep of another living animal that you can't just not show up one day because your horse is still out. And if it gets dark at night, that horse is still waiting to be fed. I did 4-H, I did Pony Club, I did FFA, I did Girl Scouts. I don't know how she found all the hours and all the days. To this day, being a grown-up, I can barely take care of me on a daily basis. I have no idea how she managed to do that. And I had a sister who was in public school who also needed extracurriculars and home time and mental and emotional and physical support. And I have a lot of issues with my dad, and that's a whole nother separate thing. But we were a whole family unit. And then on top of that, we didn't have a whole lot of money because cancer is expensive. She still managed to plan a family vacation for us every year. Sometimes it was going to grandma's house at the beach. A lot of times it was camping in Canada, but she still managed to do all those things. And so I don't know how she did it.
As you're recounting your story of what your mom is going through, she had a strong face. I already know because the way you're talking about it, it's just like, oh yeah, it's just kind of going to the grocery store, just making some errands, making some stops. It's just, wow. And now that we are adults and parents and all of that, I mean, just the amount of strength, tenacity, self-sacrifice is just jaw drop. She is doing well in that she obviously is juggling the demands of all that's going on at home and with herself and with you guys. How does she do with all those treatments?
The first three or four brain surgeries, she did really well with. The first two or three sessions of chemo, she did great with. The first two sessions of radiation were great. But when you're dragging into, I mean, don't get me wrong, I was very grateful that we had 5.5 years of time with my mom. When you're expecting 3 to 6 months and you're rounding year three, that every moment you have is a moment that you are not entitled to, and you know that they could end tomorrow. Her fifth brain surgery, she woke up with some significant deficits. She was born here in the US, but raised in Europe, predominantly Germany. So she learned to speak German when she was about 5 or 6. And she had a left frontal temporal region tumor. And so that fifth brain surgery, she woke up unable to read, write, or speak in English. But she was still able to speak and read fluently in German. I speak no German. But my mom's family, who was a significant source of support for her, particularly her brother and her mom, were both fluent in German. So I remember coming home from something once, and like, mom had bad days, just like everybody does. And I remember coming home to her angrily talking on the phone in German, because German kind of always sounds angry, but you could tell that there was frustration. Like, she needed to call somebody and vent and just have a conversation. And she was still doing speech therapy at the time. And so whenever she would try and reach out to her local support network, her best friend, her friends from church, those kind of people, nobody else spoke German. And she would get so frustrated. It was just adding insult to injury that she needs to have this session for her mental health. She needs to talk to somebody. She needs to work through some things. And it's all in her head. And she couldn't get it from her head out. That was where the disconnect was. She's like, I know exactly what I want to say. I know exactly how to write what I want to write. I know what it is up here. And there's a disconnect between her mouth and her brain, or her hand and her brain. And so I just remember her frustratingly venting on the phone in German. And then she put it on speakerphone, and it was my uncle. And he goes, I just want you to know your mom is really, really proud of you, but she's struggling today. She's really proud. She's really struggling. She's going to need a couple minutes on the phone. Can you get your sister off the bus, get a snack, start homework, whatever. And then they go back to their rapid fire German. And for me, her support network had to change a little bit in order to meet the limitations of where she was at that point. And she needed help, but she physically was unable to ask me for help. She cannot communicate what she needs to the people who are there in her daily life. And so having that kind of like reinforcement of, again, reach out to your broader network, phone a friend, phone a family member. If you have needs that can't be met by the people who are here with you right now, but you have a resource you know of, like, go ahead and reach out to that. Those lessons, I think, were very well taken to heart.
Wow. And I'm just thinking about, you already have a lot of, at that time, just engagement with hospital systems, with taking care of your mom. And then seeing this kind of anguish privately in the home, and the amount of compassion that must have really brewed in you, that kind of empathy and just wanting to help, but then feeling powerless to do so and sort of living in that space. At what point in her life, as her health started to decline, you know, where were you?
So I was in fifth, sixth grade when she first got sick. I was in eighth grade when we made the decision to no longer have mom do the education at home. So we made it about 1.5, 2 years before I started going to community college. And then I did that for 2 years before I went away to college. And I was in my junior year of always big people college when she passed away. At the time, I actually didn't want to go into people medicine. I had junior year of college is essentially like when you're starting to fill out like med school applications and all that. I don't want to say disillusioned with healthcare, but she had some fabulous people in her healthcare team all along the way. But I had spent a lot of time sitting in hospitals and treatment rooms and going to doctor's appointments. And I'd seen the limitations that healthcare had to offer. And I was like, I don't know that I can do that every day for the rest of forever. I don't know that I can wake up and make this my life for forever. But I loved medicine and I loved the science behind healthcare. So I was originally going to go to veterinary school, grew up on like a small family farm. I was like, yeah, animals, that's fantastic. I reached out for some, again, I wasn't a vet. I didn't have anybody in my family who was a vet. And I loved horses so much. I was like, oh yeah, that'll be perfect. That'll be the perfect job for me. If I were going to custom design a job for me, equine vet is it. Well, let me tell you, I shadowed equine vets in reproductive practice, in sports medicine practice, in general equine medicine practice. I shadowed a bunch of surgical vets at a practice, like a large equine hospital, an academic equine hospital. And I was, oh my God, this is even worse. You see people who have an animal who they love and they want to care for, but even if you have insurance, it's not going to pay for the healthcare for the animal. The animal is insured. Your health insurance and your life insurance are the same thing. So you've got this beloved animal that's essentially part of your family, but the medical treatment it needs is really expensive. So they're like, you can euthanize the animal and we pay you the value of the animal, or you can eat the cost and your insurance goes bye-bye and all the money you paid in is gone. And you see this more than once. You see an animal that has a readily treatable, readily manageable condition that needs significant time or a significant financial investment, and people can't afford it. And so, I mean, they choose to humanely euthanize, which I absolutely support. And I think that that's necessary. But I loved horses. I could not imagine. I would have just ended up with a field of hundreds of horses that other people couldn't do something before. And I was like, oh, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. And then, yeah, I was like, oh, maybe I'll go into something that's peripheral, like veterinary medical research. And so between undergraduate and medical school, I did 3 years of neuroplasticity research at Georgetown, thinking, oh, maybe I'll get a PhD. Maybe that will be the way for me to go. And I was like, I like people. I like the human side of medicine too much. So I don't want to say begrudgingly, but medical school is a huge financial investment. It's a huge time commitment, and it requires a very robust support network. And in the background, I had some other like family type situation things going on that made devoting my full time, my full energy, and my full focus to medicine not an option for a few years after I graduated. I was like, I think this is absolutely, definitely the way I need to go. I didn't think this was what I was going to want, but it turns out, yes, this is what I want to do. So make sure that you're really certain, because it's a lot of time. When I told my family, my extended family, that, hey, yeah, I'm applying to med school, they're like, are you sure that you just finished college? Like, you just ended. And I was like, yeah. And like, you're going to go back for 4 more years. And I was like, well, it's 4 more years of school, and then there's residency on top of that. And they're like, you're going to be old when you're done. And I'm like, yes, I am. And they're like, that's what you want. That's what we'll do, honey. Let us know where you're applying. If you need places to stay, my aunt was in the military. So when I was applying to medical schools and when I was applying to residencies, I did not pay for a single hotel room. No, I think I paid for one hotel room when I was doing residency interviews. Everywhere I was going, she's like, I know somebody in Oklahoma. I will find you some place to stay there. They'll pick you up at the airport if you got to fly in. They'll drive you to and from the hospital. I'm like, these are not my friends. These are not my mom's friends. These are my mom's little sister's friends from her days in the military. My aunt is now retired from the military. There is a whole network of people out there who are willing to support you. You just got to reach out and ask.
Yeah, I love how you leverage the network. You made a decision. You said, okay, I'm going to pursue medicine. And you mentioned, though, that, and aptly, rightly so, that this is going to take a great deal of focus and all of your attention. How did you make that commitment while still juggling the other, you mentioned some family things going on in the background?
Yeah, so I didn't know how the process worked. I half-assed, filled out, I think, 3 med school applications my senior year of college. I applied to military medical school, which turns out I'm broken and they don't take you in the military if you're broken. I'm partially deaf in 1 year, which disqualifies you from service. So this was before I had my own health challenges. But yeah, they're like, yeah, you can't come to school here. They're like, even if you get accepted, you can't come to school here. And I was like, oh, okay, good to know. And then I applied to the medical school that was associated with the hospital my mom got her treatment at, and one other medical school. I'm like, that was it. I didn't know how any of it worked. My applications were submitted days before the deadlines. And at that point, I didn't realize that like every med school interview has already been doled out at that point. So when I was at Georgetown, there was a young woman who was an MD-PhD candidate, and she had done her first 2 years of non-clinical rotations, her first 2 academic years. She was working on her PhD portion in a lab that our lab had partnered with, because my lab was just a PI and me. And she's like, oh, I heard from my boss, PI, Dr. So-and-so lady, that you want to go to medical school. And I was like, yeah, that's what I want to do. But I'm feeling really lost. I don't really know what I'm doing. Year and I like didn't get anywhere. I didn't even get any interviews. Maybe I'm not smart enough to go to medical school. Maybe this isn't what I need to do for a living. Like maybe I need to find something else. And she's like, oh no, honey, I promise you are smart enough to go. We're going to go over your application. What did you do for shadowing? I was like, what do you mean shadowing? She's like, what kind of healthcare experiences do you have? And I was going place to place with my mom. She's like, no, you got to be on the other side. You've had a lot of experiences on like the patient side, on the family side. She's like, you got to get involved on the other side. So finding people to connect me with, to get those experiences, and then literally knowing that all of your free time is going to be spent either going back to New York to deal with family court stuff for my family stuff, or my free time is going to be spent doing some sort of shadowing activity. And I had a variety of different shadowing activities from a lot of different perspectives. And there were a couple that I really enjoyed. There were a couple that I did not enjoy at all. And I was like, note to self, this is not the field of medicine for you. But understanding that you kind of, for me, for probably a year, year and a half, I put all the other parts of my life on hold. I was a swimmer in college. I dropped off. There's an adult swim team. It's like the Masters League. I had to stop doing that because it's 2 hours of swim practice 3 days a week and meets on Saturdays. And Saturdays are, the meets you do on Saturdays are not local. So I was driving from Washington, D.C. to Baltimore, Boston, New York, Connecticut, Philly, Atlanta, Georgia. And I still have a Monday through Friday, 9-to-5 job, recognizing that there are pieces of your life you're going to have to put on hold. And then just being okay with that and knowing which pieces are okay to put on hold and which pieces are not. Giving up swimming for a little while, that was a sacrifice I was willing to make. Putting my horse life on hold, which for me, from a mental health perspective, was maybe not the smartest decision I've ever made, but was what I needed in order to free up the time to still be able to go to New York, deal with family court issues, still have my full-time job, and still get those experiences that I needed to get to the next stage in life that I was aspiring to. So my whole life before then, I had always been able to somehow make it work to have it all. That was the first time in my life where I realized you can't have it all. You're going to have to make some choices. So temporarily giving up some things, temporarily putting some things on the back burner is okay. Doesn't mean you're giving up on yourself. It means you're making a choice about what's important to you right now and what you need to get to where you want to be.
I love that. Yes, because a delay is not a denial. Just, yeah, sometimes you have to make that shift and then things come back into surface. That really highlights the whole fallacy of work-life balance, because it's really not a balance. It is sometimes some things take the forefront and then others are going to take the forefront later. So it's waves, it ebbs and flows. Sounds like this person, that this MD PhD student, really helped a great deal in sort of framing and organizing your application. Did you get in your first go? Did you have to apply multiple times, or how did that go?
So the first go was like my senior year of college. I did not get in. Applying to 3 med schools, submitting super late. We took an entire year to strategize. So I met her, you know, December of my first year of working. She's like, we're going to take an entire year to strategize. You're going to miss an application cycle. And she's like, you finished college early. You're young. You've got time. There are people in their 40s who are starting med school in their 40s with a family and kids. You've got time. We're going to do this. And so hours of personal statement reviews and just experience reviews and just time like that doing that. So when I applied the next go around, so 2 years after finishing college, I applied again. And then the cycle is a year long. So like I originally only planned to work in research for 2 years. So I took a third year in that research job, which was very nice because it afforded me enough money to live on, like by no means comfortable, but like enough money to live on. Because we had talked about what are the other options? What are the non-traditional ways to get into med school? And she's like, you could do one of the like 1 year master's programs, which it's $50,000 worth of tuition. You're not going to be able to do that and do your full-time job at the time. And that would have cut off some options for me on the family court side of things. Like I needed to have a full-time job, number one, to support myself. But number two, I was trying to get custody of my younger sister at the time. And if you're suing the court for custody, you kind of need to show that like, I have a house this person could live in. I can afford to feed them. Like, okay, this is the path that's going to be viable for a lot of people. A master's, a 1 year master's somewhere, or getting an master's in public health. There are a lot of other paths that are going to be maybe better for somebody else, but like that was not an option that was realistic or feasible for me. And then the other thing we talked about was, is med school what you have to do? Are you going to be happy being a PA? Would you be happy being a nurse practitioner? Would you be happy being a bedside nurse? And the answer I came to was no. No, that was not going to be for me. That was not quite what I wanted. And she's like, all right, well, if this is what you want to do, this is what it's going to take to get there. And it's going to take you a little longer to get there. It's going to take you a little bit longer to start the process. But if that's truly what you want, you're willing to make sacrifices and work to get there, that's what we'll do.
One, I just want to just pause and thank all of those guides and coaches that we have in our lives that sort of reflect back to us and challenge us and push us and shows us this is the standard. Because many of us, if it's not around you, you don't know. I mean, how are you going to know? Right? So to be able to say, okay, here's the standard. And it's not that you're not good enough. You are. It's just the way that you're packaging yourself isn't a way that they can perceive. And so for you to be able to see the steps that you have to take As you know, at Sivo Sisters, we demystify and diversify the field of anesthesiology, all within the duration of a what? Anesthesia break. We're coming up on time. Break is probably over. Join us next week as we continue this thrilling conversation. Ta-ta! I hope you enjoyed this episode of Sivo Sisters. If you love this episode as much as I did, head on over and rate and subscribe so you don't miss out. New episodes drop every week on a Monday because we all can use a little something to get us through the week. Am I right? I'd love to hear more from you on the topics that you want to hear. So let me know in the comments. This is Dr. Peterson signing off. See you next time.